This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 10th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up on the show this week, we look at the art of promoting the big screen with design as a new international film poster competition makes a call for entrants.
We'd love to see designs which are really have a life of their own, you know, that go beyond just the film, that actually have a piece of the artist themselves in what they're creating, a piece of what their politic is, that really push the boundaries.
We meet some of Korea's finest young architects.
Seoul has changed so drastically, and the city is finding a new way to have people much more engaged in the projects itself.
And as the skies go grey, we head to sunny LA to find out about California's rich graphic design history.
We have somebody who really breaks with tradition, forges her own path, asks questions about graphic design.
All that and much more on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. Hello and welcome to Section D with me, Tom Morris. To kick off the show, we're going to explore the sometimes bold, sometimes subtle world of the film poster. So often a poster evokes a stronger mental image of a film as the motion picture itself. And from Gone with the Wind to Pulp Fiction, or to the great Polish posters of the post-war period, this genre of design is certainly a very noble art form. However, with new film viewing and distribution habits, is there space and attention for the beautifully designed film poster? A new competition hopes to make much more room for it. FilmDo, a recently launched online film discovery platform, is aiming to be the go-to place for people to discover and watch international independent films. They've just launched a film poster competition with some of the leading film, design and technology companies on board. A little earlier, I spoke to FilmDo's Virada Sucharitkul and Simon Savory to find out a little bit more.
It's a film poster design competition, but you don't have to design any posters specifically for this competition. You submit entries that you've designed before, in the past, you've worked on. We're encouraging people who want to capture the film experience in a visual, in a different way. We're not even limiting it to just graphic art. It could be photography, you know, an expression, that you know, images that they'd like. And it's open to anyone around the world and any type of films.
Because you work very much with sort of independent films, don't you?
Yes.
But it could be from blockbusters to indies.
That's correct.
What are the prizes on offer?
We're really appreciative of our supporters. We have some really amazing prizes. All top three winners will get the opportunity to work with a leading film distributor on an actual film poster to be released this year.
A paid opportunity.
Yeah. That's right. We have amazing prizes like £1,000 a voucher you could use to scan computers, £1,000 worth of courses you could use with Rain Dance, which is a leading filmmaking and production course from our supporter like Adobe. We have a 1 year Creative Cloud license, 1 year Behance Pro account where they can showcase their designs. I think Nvidia is giving some powerful video graphic cards, and Little White Lies giving a signed copy of their book, What I Like About Films.
Fantastic.
But it's amazing prizes, and the three winners will be also announced and promoted in Cannes Film Festival later this year.
And who will be judging?
So we're really lucky to have A-grade jury. We've got Mia Mattson, who is from Creative Partnership. They are a poster design agency, so they've done probably half of the films you see on the tube are from them. And she designed the original Reservoir Dogs poster.
Wow.
That's why
one of the most iconic.
Yeah, that's why we reached out to her, because I remember that from... I had to be very careful how I phrased it to her, because I said, I remember when I was a kid and I used to see these Reservoir Dogs posters, and I wasn't old enough to see the film, but they really struck a chord, and I'll always remember them, how cool they were. And I found out that she was the one who designed it, so I immediately thought, God, it would be great to have her on the panel. So yeah, she's on the jury. We've got Elliot Grove, who's the head of Rain Dance Film Festival. From Little White Lies, got Timber Smits, he's the creative director. We've got, who else have we got, Rada?
The head of marketing from Picture House Cinemas.
Yeah, so Picture House Cinemas, obviously they have their own chain of cinemas. They also distribute their own films. So he gives the sign off on a lot of film posters of movies that they release. So it's great to have him on board. We've got Tom Abel, who's the MD of Peccadillo Pictures. So they did films like Stranger by the Lake, Weekend, Tomboy. He's something of a budding artist himself, a very good one, I might add. So he's got a good eye for these things. So yeah, it's a good, varied
great bunch.
Jury.
And what I find most interesting, I mean, you are an online platform, sort of dedicated to showing the best in indie cinema. Why is the power of print still very important to the movie industry, and posters in particular?
Well, it's kind of strange irony that as a VOD platform, we're doing a film poster competition when really posters have nothing to do with the sort of VOD environment. I mean, we wouldn't be putting posters everywhere to promote our platform. We don't believe in that. But what we do believe in is that cinema and print are so closely intertwined because, you know, VOD is now, but then cinema began more than 100 years ago. And how did the word get out 100 years ago? It was on printed form. And yeah, we feel that there's a debate going on in film distribution, how first it was, you know, VHS and DVD, and now VOD is negatively impacting on cinema theatrical distribution. Whereas we feel that they can coexist side by side. And just speaking for myself and a lot of my friends, we will never stop going to the cinema to see films. Yeah. But there is also part of that debate is, well, the next generation, they are watching more and more films on their screens and fewer are going to the cinema. So we feel that by doing this competition and especially reaching out to young designers and students to sort of underline the importance of print and of movie posters and the history of posters, and to say that I think that in a strange way, when you go to the cinema, part of the experience is seeing the posters in the lobby, on the walls. And, you know, when you're queuing up to get your popcorn or to go into the cinema, you just sort of stand there and look at the posters and sort of, it entices you to go back. Mm. And that's something that you can't really do on a digital space, unless perhaps maybe through design blogs or something, I don't know. But on a VOD platform, you lose that, you know, you lose that sort of physical presence. Mm. So, yeah, we really just wanted to bring the two together.
And there's such a kind of tool to make a film iconic, you know, in visual culture. I mean, you mentioned Reservoir Dogs. It's, I've never seen the film, but I, you know, you say the word and I can just, you know, that image of those five or six guys or whatever, you know, immediately comes back. And I guess it's still so important to help, you know, films after the time they've been released and they've come out on DVD and, you know, they're watched a little bit less to keep them in the memory of the world of visual culture.
Mm. And some posters actually surpass the, you know, they have a life beyond the film itself.
Absolutely.
And that's incredible. It's publicity, it's advertising, but it's stronger than the product it's selling. I mean, I guess you could say that about some ads in general anyway, but for a film, there's just so many more layers to it, you know?
And lastly, what will you be looking for? I mean, you're looking for something that's just immediately iconic and interesting, or something truly, you know, from a graphic point of view, incredibly original and new.
For me, there's a sort of a subgenre of poster art that will always fascinate me, and it's the Polish poster art and the Turkish poster art and the Cuban poster art. And these are posters for films where really the designers, in many instances, haven't even seen the films, and they just let their imaginations run riot. And obviously in Cuba, you know, they had a lot of propaganda at the time, so they had propaganda artists coming in and just creating these insane sort of psychedelic reimaginations of films. And then in the Polish posters, you had a whole number of different artists creating just bonkers out there designs, but really beautiful and stunning and just a world apart from the film itself that they were promoting. And I'm proud to be an owner of one Polish poster, and it's a Whoopi Goldberg film. And yeah, she does not figure at all on the poster. It's just some guy getting shot. It's just bizarre. Like, had the designers seen that film? I don't think so. So we could go as far as that and saying, oh, we'd love to see designs which are really have a life of their own, you know, that go beyond just the film, that actually have a piece of the artist themselves in what they're creating, a piece of what their politic is, really push the boundaries. But then sometimes it's good to see films that reimagine the film itself. So when Black Swan came out, there was a series of posters, sort of 1920s inspired Art Nouveau posters, and that were just absolutely stunning and really took the film to another place. Mm. So, I mean, you can go in all sorts of different directions. I think just a real sense of identity, but at the same time, a respect for the language of cinema, a combination of the two.
Fantastic. And how do people apply?
If you go to filmdude.com/creativity, that's where our competition page is. They upload their film artwork, or if they already have their film artwork, on behance.net, which is an Adobe platform. And then they've just copy the link of that Behance artwork onto the submission form, have a FilmDo account, and then submit enter. And it's very straightforward.
And you'll come back when the winner's announced and talk us through some of your favourites?
Absolutely.
Of course, we'll do our best to describe how amazing they look.
That was me speaking to Virada Sucharitkul and Simon Savory of online film platform FilmDo on their newly launched film poster design competition. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, the world is quickly becoming familiar with all manner of Korean exports, from its famous fermented dish kimchi to all the flashy bling of the Korean pop music industry. The country is no cultural wallflower. Korean design and architecture, however, sometimes struggle to step up on the global podium. But a new government-backed exhibition in London hopes, in part, to change that. Out of the Ordinary, award-winning works by young Korean architects, hopes to highlight Korea's new urban, social and economic paradigm as expressed by a set of very different architects. David Pleasant went along to the exhibition, which is at the Cass Bank Gallery in London's chaotic and ever-changing Whitechapel neighbourhood.
I'm Hyungmin Pei. I'm a professor at the University of Seoul. I curated this exhibition. It's titled Out of the Ordinary. So I'm here to take care of the installation and to have a good time with our opening. From the past 24 awardees, I selected 9 architects who I thought were doing very exciting work. Some of them, of course, have grown older since they had been first selected, but I wanted to show the kind of creativity that has emerged in the last 7 years in relation to a very fundamental transformation in Korean society. The 08 global financial crisis, of course, has impacted every place in the world. But in terms of Korean architecture, it was particularly drastic because Korean economy had relied for decades on construction and real estate growth. And it's not that the country is in deep economic crisis. In fact, it's relatively speaking, it's doing quite well. And so it has emerged as a developed country. It's one of the wealthiest countries in the world. So it's not the economic downfall itself. The society culturally is much more sophisticated, mature. In terms of architecture, the society is much more interested in architectural culture. And so the young architects who have to work in this situation have the difficulty that there's not much building opportunity. But on the other hand, society is very, very much more interested in architecture. So they have to create certain niches for themselves.
I'm a Korean architect. My name is Haewon Shin. I'm principal of local design. I'm one of the 9 architects participating in this exhibition in London at the Cass Gallery.
And we are standing by your area of the exhibition. The curator described your work kind of in one sentence as anything but buildings, inferring that a lot of your work is quite subtle interventions. Maybe explain the breadth of your work and some of the ones that have been chosen here at this exhibition.
I got involved in the Han Renaissance project, which is about renovating the existing pedestrian passageways into the river from the city center, which was completely dark, very derelict space, dark spaces. And then we had to create it into a much more inviting entrances to and out of the city to the river. So that was a part of the public projects that I started to get engaged with, and that's influenced the type of projects that are involved in Seoul and in Korea.
And also kind of a theme perhaps with a lot of the other architects that have been chosen is this sort of changing Korea, and the social kind of dynamic of the country is changing, the economy is changing, that it's less about growth now, kind of new era of lower, more stable growth perhaps. How's that kind of reflected, you think, in your work, in your commissions and the kinds of things that you've been doing? Is it the scale? Is it the sort of philosophy in terms of what you're doing? We're looking now at a low-income housing project in a poorer area of Seoul, and perhaps this particular project reflects what's been happening in Korea lately.
It's interesting because how I started also my practice in Seoul is local design. I participated in the Venice Biennale 2006 exhibition on the theme of Catalog City, which is actually looking at the phenomenon of apartments. There was people were crazed about developments in high-rise apartment housing. And then it's interesting that last year, in starting up 2012, that I work in a public project housing scheme, which is not about building, erasing the landscape, and actually think about kind of low-rise, more residence-engaging projects. So this is a drastic shift since then till now, where I think the social, economic condition, where also the new mayor, Park Won-soon, who gives this initiative possible, because already the Seoul has changed so drastically, and the city is finding a new way not to actually appreciate this historic context, also to have people much more engaged in the projects itself.
I think as a large discipline, I think architecture has the fundamental principles are basically not that different. You have to build well, you have to be smart, you have to think about space, you have to think, so those kind of basic principles, I think, is applicable to most societies. But what I think differentiates the work, what brings a peculiar character to each society's architecture is, of course, its local conditions, its local sites. And so I think what brings the architecture that's exhibited here is the local reality in which they work in. And so when you are true to your reality, when you are true to your site, you are true to the conditions of your project, that's when that kind of general architectural principles or ways of practice take on a new kind of distinct flavor.
Perhaps explain the role the photography here has had. It's certainly not a normal architecture exhibition whereby buildings are kind of put on pedestals and shot in these, super shiny, sterile way. Maybe explain exactly what you've exhibited and how you've chosen to do that.
In my curatorial experience, I understand that people will do what they do. Certain architects will do what they do. You cannot force them to do something that they don't want to do or not prone to do. And so when I select the architects, I know what kind of things they will do. And I know that when they present, most architects will always present their work centered on their work. And I don't expect them to do anything else. But at the same time, you want a show that has different kinds of viewpoints, perspective, and particularly in London where you assume that the audience is not that familiar with the Korean condition. And so you want different elements that show how these individual architectural works are placed. And so I commissioned two photographers, two very different photographers, to include the works, but not to have them as the focus. And you are individual artist. The only condition is to include that individual work, but you can take any kind of angle you want. And I think it's worked wonderfully. I think the idea that the combination of them, the presentations by the individual architects, and then the independent photographic commissions will sort of interact and bring a kind of overall where you have different perspective, different views. And I think it's worked. I'm very happy with that.
That was David Pleasant with Hyungmin Pei, curator of Out of the Ordinary, award-winning works by young Korean architects, which is on this month at the Cass Bank Gallery here in London. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, where we will be back straight after this.
Globes, spoons, and weaving. Monocle Films drops in on three makers helping to reinvigorate the British capital's artisanal heartbeat.
There's a real readiness for people to connect with natural materials and to have, aspects of these highly laboured objects in their living lives. And just to have a few special things is actually more precious than having 100.
Made in London, premiering in the film section of monocle.com.
Now, from architecture and development in Korea, which we heard about just before the break, to urban change and renewal here in London at and around King's Cross Station. With so much development in this area, as a resident, visitor or passerby, it can be hard to take in all the transformation. So rapid have been the building works. using part historical documents, part artistic license, and part fully blown fiction. Artist Anne Howison has been busy drawing a testament to the King's Cross redevelopment. Present in the past, renovation and revival in King's Cross Central is a collection of 30 drawings being exhibited at the Collier Bristol Gallery until the 25th of February. I sat down with Anne to discuss her subject matter and technique and the pros and cons of gentrification. So let's start with, I mean, why King's Cross?
All my work is about place and always has been. But for the past 5 years, I've been really focusing on King's Cross, partly from the point of view of a local, actually. Mm. I just live there and I've got a dog and I walk along the canal and always have done and have lived in this gritty area for most of my life. And I just became intrigued by the changes.
Yeah. And I guess King's Cross is the ultimate case study in urban regeneration. I mean, in my sort of, I've lived in London for 12 years, but seen it transform entirely. And yeah. So you've sort of got about charting that and documenting it, haven't you?
Well, I've read that it's the largest area of urban redevelopment in Europe. Not sure if that's factually true. But yes, I got drawn in really from the point of view of, as I said, a local. And my approach is definitely not an art historian's or an architectural historian's. I'm approaching it in quite a poetic way. I love the buildings. In the first show I had, which was at The Guardian, I was commemorating quite a lot of the old buildings and trying to remember them before they got pulled down. Some have gone, the disappeared, I call them. For instance, Culross buildings. Mm-hmm. People know that one's gone. And the buildings became a bit like people to me. That show had very few people in it. And it was at that show that somebody from the Museum of London turned up and bought some work and asked me if I'd like to go and have a look at their collection and respond to the archives there. So I started to visit.
So it must have been quite a sort of a treasure trove to access and look to, no?
Exactly. The first thing I found out about, I learned a new word, Solander. Solander boxes were opened up by the head curator there, and out came these prints, which is why the second exhibition has happened. Mm-hmm. It's called Present in the Past, and it tries to look at life as it is today, and also looking to the future and back to the past. And the starting point for this show, the images in this show, are all about prints that I found in these boxes in various archives, starting with the Museum of London and moving on to the London Metropolitan Archives.
And how far do we go back? I mean, this is sort of pre-Victorian industrial era, isn't it? Which I think most people associate with King's Cross.
Well, quite a few of the ones are early 18th century, but they go back and up to 19th century, late 19th century.
And how have you gone about, because there are 30 drawings in the exhibition, aren't there? And how have you gone about sort of collating them all? How did you sort of piece together all these little treasures and finds that you found into one sort of succinct image?
Well, it was like a kind of continuous quest in a way. The more I found out, the more I had to trail. One thing that was very exciting about working on these images was that you didn't have to deal with a white page. That's fantastic. As an artist, there's nothing worse than that piece of white paper. But in this case, I had a starting point. And so what I would do is choose images that intrigued me in a kind of poetic, intuitive way. Yeah. And rub bits them out, subvert them, change them, and try and imagine a future in a situation, for example, like the dust heap, which was referred to by Dickens in Our Mutual Friend. Those dust heaps stood. I know where they stood. You can sort of feel their presence still in that area at the back of King's Cross Station. There's another area leading up from there called Maiden Lane, which is now known as York Way, which was very well known for its tile kilns. The tile kilns used to make bricks because it was, again, an area of regeneration at that time. Yeah. What's strange, as I've said in my description, is that it is an area which reminds one of a sort of palimpsest. There are layers of history and strange sort of repeated moments. For example, the hullabaloo that went on at the back of the station when the Midland Line brought their rail track through to St Pancras back in the mid-19th century. Mm-hmm. And there was an outcry because there were lots of bodies buried very deep and they had to be exhumed. People weren't happy, not surprisingly. And similarly, I think there are people now who aren't happy about some of the changes which have happened or had to happen. And I think with Crossrail are still happening.
Could you talk us, you know, to some of our global listeners, talk us through what King's Cross is like now? I mean, it's gone from this very kind of Charles Dickens-y industrial, real epicentre of London, and then incredibly grimy for decades. And it's actually now is one of the best, most shiny examples of a huge gentrification project.
Well, from a local's point of view, it's turning out to be somewhere very exciting to visit. I mean, obviously, there are lots of places to eat, relax. There are squares. There are going to be avenues. There's a university. I think there's going to be a school. There are swimming pools. The thing is, it is rather corporate from an architectural point of view, which personally I would prefer it not to be quite so corporate, but realistically that was going to happen. And they have preserved quite a lot of the charming earlier buildings that I'm so in love with, like the Coal and Fish offices, which is going to be Jamie Oliver's cookery school, I just heard. But what's quite interesting is that now the area is still associated, I find this very interesting, with issues to do with health. There's the Wellcome Trust quite nearby. There's the Crick Institute. In the prints that I discovered in the archive, what fascinated me were places like the Smallpox Hospital, one of the first prints I found, which used to stand on the footprint of King's Cross, just about where King's Cross Station is. One of my images draws the Smallpox Hospital as a sort of ghostly shadow within the railway station, because I feel its presence very strongly, although it was pulled down in, I think, something like 1850 to make way for the rail to go into King's Cross Station. And there was another place called St Pancras Wells, which was where people used to go, poor things, to get cures by drinking the mineral waters. They had no other way of curing kidney stones breaking out in scurvy or spots than drinking these waters. That stood very near St Pancras Church, which of course still exists.
Yeah,
you can go and visit it now.
Is this a comment? This is obviously a big comment on gentrification, but would you say it's a good or a bad thing in the fact that, you know, you've charted so many waves of the ups and the downs of the area?
I don't think it's good or bad. I think it's inevitable. You've got to be realistic. I think they've done fairly well. As I said, I'm not wanting to comment from the point of view of an architect, but as a local, I mean, we've already got a wonderful cultural centre, which is very interesting because it doubles as an office. That's King's Place, and a cultural centre where one can now hear these marvellous concerts and talks. It's got a fairly good mix of uses. It's got quite a lot of residential accommodation. It's got some open spaces. It's got the water. It's making the canal a kind of lovely place to be. It's fairly heartening how sort of thoughtful a lot of the development is, in my view.
And how do you feel sort of as an artist, you know, these images that you've done will almost enter the canon of all the archives that you've raided over the years? Do you sort of take that into consideration that in sort of 20, 30 years, perhaps 100 years, people look back to these as charting, you know, what to come before in King's Cross, but will also become historical then?
I've taken a lot of liberties. As I said, I'm very much approaching it from the point of view of a sort of visual poet. My pictures are imagining a future that may never exist. Sometimes I'm putting in, before the buildings went up, I was putting in buildings and calling it the fictional future of the area. I guess that my pictures aren't trying to predict, but they're enjoying a kind of quest, an intuitive journey into place.
How long have they taken you to do? I mean, they're so intricate.
I'm a very slow... I enjoy detail. And I also, what I've really enjoyed with these pieces is the sort of conversation I've had with the earlier artists. There's a sense of walking in their footsteps, even sort of drawing on top of their lines. It's slightly spooky, but very exciting. And in some cases, I have to admit that the earlier prints I felt rather critical of as an artist, and I felt I want to improve this composition or add details which will make it work slightly better, very arrogantly.
I'm sure it's worked. Fantastic. Thank you very much for joining us. That's really fascinating. And the show is open until?
The show's open until February the 26th at Collier Bristow, and you need to contact Collier Bristow to find out more details.
That was me speaking to artist Anne Howison about her exhibition, Present in the Past, Renovation and Revival in King's Cross Central, which is at London's Collier Bristow Gallery until the 25th of February. Check the website for details on how to visit. This is Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Now, as distinctive and visually gripping as it was, Californian design from the 20th century has seldom been looked at. Without a formal tradition, and as a reaction to East Coast and European norms, new and vibrant design took over the state from the height of modernism through the swinging 60s, ending and trailing off in the mid-80s. Louise Sandhouse tracked this period and has written a colourful book, Earthquakes, Mudslides, Fires and Riots, California and Graphic Design, 1936 to 1986, published by Thames and Hudson.
Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Louise to find out why such a state-specific anthology was necessary. If you're going to San
Francisco, be sure to wear... First of all, Louise, the book is a delight. It looks very nice as well. And, you know, it's a look at a graphic design in California last century. My first question, what was so relevant about the whole movement?
Well, let me answer that by saying I think what was most distinctive is that we think of a voice of graphic design starting with Europe, and in particular we associate it with the Bauhaus. But I felt like there was something distinctive that emerged out of California, and I didn't feel like that had properly been taken a look at, where at the turn of the 21st century, the LA County Museum of Art took a look at California art and tried to identify something that was distinctive about how it was responding to images in the culture. I began to see that there was a moment at which California artists had turned their back on what was coming out of New York and what was coming out of Europe, and that they decided to define for themselves what art was and what art looked like. And so it was with that impetus that I began to look at California graphic design.
And it's very interesting, there's something also from California on the title of the book, you know, because it's called Earthquakes, Mudslides, Fires, and Riots. And of course, after Californian graphic design, 1936, 1986. So what did you try to say with that, you know, the earthquakes, mudslides, fires, and riots?
Well, first of all, was the whimsy of the title. And to talk about a certain kind of disruption, to talk about the characteristics that people kind of associate in a way with the physical landscape. But also, I wanted to use that as a kind of analogy or metaphor of the break from certain traditions, that it was dramatic, and that maybe psychologically, because there was nothing stable about the ground here and about the social conditions, that perhaps evoked a certain kind of freedom that would allow people not to worry about traditions, because those would shift and change and there would be upheaval.
And also the book, you know, the period, I mean, I said it last century, but actually in the title, it also says it's from 1936 to 86. Can you tell us why 1936 and why 86?
So I think about two bookends. First, beginning in 1936 with a book by Merle Armitage, who was a music impresario, who comes to California, I believe in the 20s, and he took it upon himself to try and circulate to a larger public across the United States and the world the arts that were happening here, like Martha Graham was out here, and Edward Weston was out here, Igor Stravinsky, among others. And he wanted to publish the work of these artists, these groundbreaking artists, and so he took it upon himself to design some publications about them. And he just had such a individualistic, idiosyncratic voice and approach to book design, really breaking with the traditions of book design and formulating his own ideas about what modern book design was like. So when I saw his book on Igor Stravinsky, called Stravinsky, that he designed, he starts the book off with one of the essays on the cover, and then inside the book he has eight portraits by Edward Weston of Stravinsky, and it almost becomes a kind of fun, bizarre, self-conscious recognition of the celebrity portrait. So it seems like there's a kind of commentary there. So everything about his approach to the book's design and the reading experience seemed to be unique. Then 50 years later, we have April Greiman and her poster/magazine for the Walker Art Center's Design Quarterly called Does It Make Sense? And again, we have somebody who really breaks with tradition, forges her own path, asks questions about graphic design, like, what is the subject matter? And why these kinds of categories of magazine or poster? Couldn't they be both? How do you write or introduce a subject? And what do you say about that subject? So again, we have these two individuals who I think embody a kind of California aesthetic and a California attitude. And it was a nice 50 years that seemed to neatly package what might be covered in this material.
I wanted to ask about the graphic design scene in California nowadays. Do you think they look back at this period? You know, do you think it's still quite influential, or today is totally different of what it was?
I think that now we have something that a colleague of mine, Jeff Keaty, refers to as global design, that because so much material can be circulated, that the influences are shared and the ideas are shared, plus we have a situation of global commerce, and that creates expectations that are more universal in terms of what things look like. But I think that you can't help but look at California as a place where it is sunny, where, you know, pop culture is still finding a very comfortable home here. So I think out of the kind of cultural experiences that are here, you're going to create something quite different. Every place is a product of the local educational institutions. So, you know, in California, there's California College of the Arts and Art Center College of Design and CalArts, among many other institutions. And I think that there's a kind of lineage out of those institutions as well. But I think it's somewhat trickier in this period of time, and I wouldn't say this is just California, but everywhere, the kind of experimentation that we've seen for decades and that I'm associating with certain kinds of experimentation with California, that now we're going to have to, I think, step back in a few years and look back and say, what was going on? Was there anything particular? So there's nothing I can point to at this moment. Gentle people
with flowers in their hair. That was Louise Sandhaust, author of Earthquakes, Mudslides, Fires and Riots, California and Graphic Design from 1936 to 1986. Still to come on the show, we'll be getting the lowdown on the big architectural news stories from around the world and hear how to bring brutalism to life with paper. Now it's that time of the show when we get an industry update. This week we're talking the recent big architectural news stories, from paper bag buildings in Sydney to the ever-increasing threat big name architects have on architectural criticism. A little bit earlier, I caught up with Alan G. Brake, executive editor of the Architects newspaper, who spoke to me from our New York bureau. So, Alan, let's start with quite a controversial building that's finally completed in Sydney, to the gawping eyes of many locals, hasn't it?
Yes, Frank Gehry has completed a building for the University of Technology in Sydney, and it's been quickly dubbed the paper bag building.
And why is that? Let's describe it.
So it has these sort of folded, kind of undulating masonry walls that are brown like a paper bag, which are punctuated by these punched out windows that sort of give it a slightly faceted quality. Gehry's done a kind of number of these buildings before, you know, maybe not with this kind of highly articulated masonry as in this case. But what's slightly sort of maybe funny about this project is that the facade has this slightly drooping quality. You know, it's like a crumpled paper bag, you know, or a paper bag that's gotten a little bit wet. So it's aroused a bit of, humor maybe has attached itself to the project already.
Yeah, and criticism.
Indeed, yeah. Of course, the mayor and the president of the university are hailing it as this sort of major architectural masterpiece, you know, to rival the Sydney Opera House. But, you know, when people are already comparing the project to a paper bag, I think that's a bit of a reach.
What do you think the sort of the situation is when, you know, a huge, huge legendary architect like Frank Gehry, increasingly over the past maybe decade or so, starts kind of pimping out his style to just about anyone who with a budget to pay?
And, you know, there's been successes and there's been a lot of failings like this. What do you think happens to an architect when, you know, they sort of develop into their career and so many cities and people want a look of a Frank Gehry building, but just sometimes it just doesn't work?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is, you know, always the combination of the client, the architect, and the program of the project. You know, this reminds me of a building he did a number of years ago in Cleveland at Case Western Reserve University, which, you know, there were lots of controversies around the amount of money that was spent on the building. They had all these problems there with ice shedding. It was actually extremely dangerous to be around the building whenever there was snow or ice, you know, because it would slide off in these massive sheets. And it was very, very kind of scary, I think, for passersby. So, as you say, it's a mixed bag.
Now, from one star architect to another, Zaha Hadid has recently settled a case against the New York Review of Books, hasn't she?
Yes, this was a rather messy episode as well. A very well-respected New York critic named Martin Filler wrote a piece criticizing Hadid, although the piece wasn't actually about her at all. And he made a factual error in his review and sort of misattributed a quote that she had made about another project where she appeared to be rather insensitive to some worker safety issues on the sites of her projects. He then retracted the story, apologized, but Hadid then sued him and the New York Review of Books for defamation.
And that's now been settled?
It has been settled. The terms of the settlement have not been disclosed, which, you know, of course, everyone's speculating about that. I mean, was it a large sum of money? No one really knows. The New York Review is a very well-respected but quite small publication, so I don't know how deep their pockets are. She also then donated the money from the settlement to sort of worker safety, worker rights groups to prove that she does care about these issues on her sites and, you know, on work sites around the world. The interesting thing, I mean, the sort of scale of what we're talking about here is quite interesting to me in that, you know, Hadid is, of course, one of the world's most famous architects. She has a huge firm. She works all over the world. And for her to react in this extremely strong way against, you know, a New York-based writer writing for a modest circulation kind of intellectual magazine, the kind of PR optics around that are, I think, are a little strange. And, you know, I wonder if maybe she and her team sort of overreacted to this issue.
Yeah. And what does it say in the, you know, sort of the broader aspect of things? What does it say about architectural criticism? You know, you as an editor at the Architects newspaper, is it a threat? Is it a worry that, you know, these architects with such huge, you know, budgets to sue and defame whatever they want? Is it a cause for concern?
Well, it's definitely unusual. I mean, we, of course, always try to stick to our facts at the Architects newspaper. And I think Filler was very contrite in admitting his error. To my end, it should have stopped there. But I think architectural criticism, I think design criticism, I think good reporting, I think all those are very important things and I think lead to a better built environment, which is something that we should all be working towards.
Exactly. And talking of working towards things, our thoughts now turn to May, of course, when New York Design Week will kick off. The dates have just been announced, haven't they, and all the major program.
Yeah, so it's cold and chilly here in New York now, so we're all looking forward to the spring. New York Design Week is actually about 10 or 11 days now. A couple of years ago, it was sort of coordinated under a new initiative called New York by Design. And there are sort of six major fairs that have sort of different emphasis and different qualities throughout that 10-day period.
And what are the highlights we're looking forward to this year?
Well, it starts with Brooklyn Designs, which is a very small, has traditionally been quite a small fair, and it really focuses on sort of artisanal made, small manufacturing furniture, objects, things like that by firms and companies based in Brooklyn. It then sort of scales all the way up to ICFF, which is the main kind of large commercial fair, which is May 16th through the 19th. And then in between there is Wanted Design Brooklyn, Wanted Design Manhattan, which is kind of the second biggest fair, the Collective Design Fair, which is more sort of vintage design galleries, sort of for established collectors. And then there's the Frieze Art Fair, which also coincides with New York by Design.
Will Sight Unseen Offsite be returning, which was my highlight last year?
Yeah, no, I loved that show. I'm actually not sure about that. I was curious to see it. It wasn't in the kind of major rollout, so I'm not sure. It's, you know, one of the smaller, but I think one of the more exciting developments from last year's Design Week. So we'll see if they're able to pull that back together again.
Now let's talk about a new plan for a massive, huge affordable housing development in Queens, isn't there?
Yeah, so New York's mayor, Bill de Blasio, ran on this very ambitious plan to build or preserve 200,000 units of affordable housing, which is a really astonishing number. No one was quite sure how he was going to get there, and you know, his plans were a bit vague in the beginning. So now he's just had his second State of the City address, and a big piece of that came out. He's proposing to build a major, about 12,000 unit affordable housing development over a rail yards in Queens. It's very close to Manhattan. There's a large rail yard, so they would have to build a deck over this active rail yard in order to build these units.
What's the general take on his kind of commitment to good design and public space and housing and things like that? Is the design community behind it or very skeptical about what he's doing?
You know, I think everyone wants New York to be affordable to a broad range of people. De Blasio's predecessor, Michael Bloomberg, you know, had less of an emphasis on affordability and very much an emphasis on good design. So I think when Bloomberg left, there was a lot of concern about the new mayor. And I think we're still trying to figure out where he stands on a lot of these issues, on public space, on new parks, on transportation, sustainability. A lot of the things that Mayor Bloomberg really, really emphasized seem to have been less of a priority for de Blasio, whereas this affordable housing push seems to be his entire sort of driving force at this point on the kind of built environment side.
That was Alan Brake, executive editor of the Architects newspaper, joining me on the line from New York. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, where we'll be back straight after this.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. And to end the show, let's go to Poland to hear from a Spanish designer who is rather fond of British brutalism. As if we needed proof of the intense reappreciation of post-war architecture around the world, Polish studio Supergrafica has released a collection of five paper cutout models representing London's brutalist architecture from the 1960s and 1970s. It seems that every week we're celebrating brutalism here on Section D, and now the buildings can be cut, folded and constructed yourself. Let's hear from Poznan-based designer David Navarro and why he decided to produce these little tributes to some once-hated grey towers.
When we started the studio, we started as well to make cutout collections of the modernist architecture of Poland, mainly prefab panel blocks, what is called here Bielka Płyta. Brutal London is a continuation of other collections, mainly in Poland, Warsaw and Poznan. It's a collection of cutout models that represent brutalist architecture of London from the 60s to the 70s. The collection is made of five illustrated models to assemble and exhibit all kind of original details present on the building's facades. This is a kind of tour that begins with kind of iconic tower blocks like Balfron Tower, Space House, as well as some council estates that are doomed to premature demolition like Robin Hood Gardens and Aylesbury Estate. And a classic example of prefab panel block that is Ledbury Estate. We started this collection because we were invited in London Design Festival the previous year, and we were displaying the collection of Warsaw Eastern Block. And we just have a closer look to the brutalist examples in London. As well, we were very interested in visiting Aylesbury and Highgate as well. Maybe because of Highgate was something that we wanted to visit, maybe because this film, Harry Brown, that we were really amazed about the environment. And when we realized that being in Highgate and we were looking around and we realized that we didn't see it at all. And we realized then that it was totally demolished in front of our eyes. No? So when we went to Aylesbury, we decided that maybe it was a good idea, a natural step to continue our collection with London, to somehow collect or illustrate the buildings that probably we won't see anymore in the future. Making these models is kind of long time realization. We first of all make a lot of photos of the buildings, all the details of the facades, everything that we can find, like even graffitis or antennas and general views. When we have all the documentation of each building, we illustrate them. This is the base to illustrate them by layers. We apply textures, all the details that are originally founded in the facades. It's a kind of complex process. Brutalist architecture reminds us mainly the prefab panel blocks remind us a lot to the polis architecture of Bill Capuita, of prefab panel. The unique pieces that you find inside this repetition, the textures, is like an hypnotic concrete dance, no? A concrete dance that make it very powerful. This is what attracts us more from this kind of architecture. The whole collection of Brutal London is printed in a special paper that is 100% recycled with a special texture. And when we make the models, we don't really take into account a specific scale, but we realize them to fit in an A4. This is more important for us than a specific exact scale of the model.
That was David Navarro of Polish studio Zupergrafika talking us through the London and Warsaw Brutalist paper cutouts that he produces. And that is all we have time for on this edition of Section D. Today's show is produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer David at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you have any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris, and now time for a farewell song. All that talk of Reservoir Dogs a bit earlier leaves us no option but to play you this, Little Green Bag. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.